Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, 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 what's up, world? It's Badass Thugging like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond.
Yo, yo, check this out. This is your girl, Cola Vogue, and I'm chilling with my boys right here on Off the Cuff Radio. We off the cuff right now. You big?
What's up? It's your boy Lil Yap from LV, bragging up from the river, cooling with my homies and my family at Off the Cuff Radio. Y'all be sure to tune in on Fridays and get the latest scoop and find out what's happening. You hear me?
Tiffany Levine.
And it's Queen Crazy, your girl, favorite bartender.
And we're from
Sex on the Rocks podcast.
Alright, you're now tuning in to Off the Cuff Radio.
Yeah, because they keep representing that world hip hop. Well, much love.
Alright.
Love y'all. This is Miss Irresistible, and you're listening to Off the Cuff giving a shout out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio. And I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
Hey y'all, this is Stacey Lachey giving a shout out to King Eric and Off the Cuff Radio.
What's shaking, y'all? This is the Grand, one half of Lost Cause and one third of that Drive Time thing. Sending my love to the homies over at Off the Cuff Radio. Tune in every Friday night for some real deal hip-hop conversation. These dudes are the connoisseurs of this thing. You already know what it is. BX Stand Up, Hud City, what's shaking? Peace.
Yo, this is Joe Fresh Design, and y'all tuned in to the most raw, uncut show on radio. The Guillotine Scene, Off the Cuff, and yo, Eric Sandman, Off the Cuff Clown.
On every block, singing the dramatics and playing with Ready Rock. Usually it seems like he waiting to catch a drop. You're clinging to his habits, he's saving you from a spot. Round of wave work, jewels in the crown, hit the tape dirt. Love is love, you in good hands, Dennis Haysbert. Openly protected by who you be neck and neck with. See you looking over like, look at what they done made work. Circling the block, I know your call before you start. Put your phone down, Pierre Moss to the hard. Word to all of that, love it or leave it, we afforded that. 20D batteries, count them wrong, bought them back. Attracted to what you see on the screen, but then thinking you could recast it to keep what you need. Keep it cool, shit is cold, you don't need me to leave. Word to God, it's nothing to let you be who you be. I mean for real though, there's a vibe still in the sky. 30 floors up, burnt the vibe clear out the sky. I had a view worth a mil, but views get for real. And views you get killed when you ain't hit a vibe. There's a vibe still in the sky. 30 floors up, burnt the vibe clear out the sky. I had a view worth a mil, but views get for real. And views you get killed when you ain't hit a vibe. Please, Philly, don't let this happen to you. Please, Atlanta, don't let this happen to you. Please, DMV, don't let this happen to you. Please, LA, don't let this happen to you. Please, Detroit, don't let this happen to you. Please, Chicago, don't let this happen to you. Please, Texas, don't let this happen to you. Please, New Orleans, don't let this happen to you. To whom it may concern, don't let this happen to you. True to what you heard, they want this back like a loop. They gave you a curve and kept you back on the stoop. And now what they prefer is to help you pack when you move. And an argument is made for calling out a plane. Visions of a doorstep and all that it became. And they ain't had a heart to stand on until today. Smoke all clear and they just wanting to remain. Funny, ain't it? The bottom of the bag is what you make it. Jump the line, cause I ain't never seen money waiting. Shit you ran from is what you trying to run away with. And brownstones are flipping salvation underrated. So let's tag a dotted line if you care to survive. And if not, pick a spot and just be here for the ride. The aura of quarter waters over Mary J. Blige. My neighborhood give you life, but was you here when it died? Riddle me that, right? Cause the vibe fell in the sky. 30 floors up, burnt the vibe clear out the sky. I had a view worth a mil, but views get for real and usually get killed when you ain't hit a vibe.
Remember
when this vibe fell in the sky. burning vibes, clouds in the sky. I had a view of Romel, but views you for real, and views you get killed when you ain't hit a vibe. Please, Philly, don't let this happen to you. Please, Atlanta, don't let this happen to you. Please, DMV, don't let this happen to you. Please, LA, don't let this happen to you. Please, Detroit, don't let this happen to you. Please, Chicago, don't let this happen to you. Please, Texas, don't let this happen to you. Please, New Orleans, don't let this happen to you. Block party every summer, 40 acres and a mule. Same block where it was from and it became a living proof. Last of a dying breed, praises is due. While you cursing off the stage from your roof. Came here, itching for the vibe, take it with us if we gone. No money in styles, blame the pictures on the wall. A box of Kennedy fried, got you thinking you involved. Should've smooth, I was dead too before I moved along. Funny, yeah, there I cause the vibe fell on the side. 30 floors up, burnt the vibe clear out the sky. I had a view worth a mil, but views get for real. And usually get killed when you ain't hit a vibe. Then there's a vibe fell on the side. 30 floors up, burnt the vibe clear out the sky. I had a view worth a mil, but views get for real. And when you ain't hit by. Please, Philly, don't let this happen to you. Please, Atlanta, don't let this happen to you. Please, DMV, don't let this happen to you. Please, LA, don't let this happen to you. Please, Detroit, don't let this happen to you. Please, Chicago, don't let this happen to you. Please, Texas, don't let this happen to you. Please, New Orleans, don't let this happen to you. Chopped cheese and Kennedy fried and dollar Arizonas and four wings with fried rice and extra duck sauce. All of the reasons you was out front for coming with us if we up and gone. Chopped cheese and Kennedy fried and dollar Arizonas and four wings with fried rice and extra duck sauce. All of the reasons you was out front for coming with us if we up and gone. Best eyes burning.
Y'all, this your boy King Ed the Great. You're now tuned in to Off the Cuff Radio. I got my host T-Mask with the facts in the building.
What it do, what it do. Monday night flight. We are live and direct. It's OTCF in the building. Shout out to our co-host and a lot of Sandman, Lady Chinchilla, So Ella. We are sponsored by Quartz Financial, Ty Venti Clothing, Buddy Boy Entertainment, Jesse's Boutique, and Dirty Basement Radio. And we about to make it moving, man. What's going on, King?
What's going on? Now, I'm a roll the dice here, man, because I don't know if this is our guest of the night on, but I'm going to see for myself. We might have Sky Zoo on the line. Let me make sure.
Okay, let's check it.
Peace.
What's
peace.
Good, brother?
What's peace, God. What it do, man?
What's going on? What's going on? How y'all doing?
We good.
Hey,
we
man,
good. Glad to have you on with.
Blessed.
Word up. That's what it is. No doubt.
And first of all, I want to say this, man. Congratulations on this recent project you just dropped, man. I've been having it on rotation since it dropped. Fire project, man.
Oh, man.
Hip hop pushing.
Well, thank you, man. I appreciate that, man. I appreciate the love and you know how you've been keeping it on rotation, like you said. You know, I appreciate that. It means a lot.
Definitely, man. I'm looking at this CD myself in my crib, the Milestones joint. You know, when I picked it up, Scott, you know what I'm saying, obviously Furious and Trey from Boys in the Hood, man, you know, a picture says 1,000 words indeed. And you painted murals with your magnificent MC and over the years, and to use that picture from a, you know, legendary movie that spoke so much about, you know, the street life, you know, family life, friends, coming of age, an amalgam of so many different areas of the human existence is just a further testament to your tremendous talent, man. You know, Brooklyn's very own, you know, we're glad to have you with us, man.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. You know, everything you said is why I do what I do the way I do it, you know, for people to feel that and for people to get that and connect to it on those levels that you just described. So when I hear those things, it means job well done. So I appreciate all that for real.
Definitely.
And you're crafting this project together, my man, first and foremost, like, what was the mentality that you had going in? Like, were you trying to go in to outdo your previous projects, or you just wanted to bring a new philosophy into it?
Well, you're talking about All the Brilliant Things or Milestones? Because I know you were just talking about Milestones as far as, you know, Trey,
yes,
Furious, and all that.
Yes.
that album is about fatherhood. So it wasn't about, mm-hmm. you know, one-upping anything else. It was a conceptual project. You know, that album is about the relationships, you know, with fathers and sons, specifically in the city, you know, specifically where we come from, and the lack of fathers, but then also the fathers that are there and how they don't get the cred and don't get the recognition, and how important it is to be a stand-up father and to be there 100%. You know, that's what that album's about. So it wasn't about any other project or one-upping anything or whatever. I literally said, man, I want to do a project about fatherhood as somebody who's a young black father who grew up with a young black father, never went a day without having my dad in my life when all of my friends were the opposite. I wanted to talk about that. I didn't feel like there were enough records that represented fatherhood in a positive light in hip-hop. So that's what that record's about.
Got
it. And one thing about – go ahead, King.
You go ahead.
Yeah, one thing about it, Sky, you know, you follow in such a distinguished tradition of MCing on Wax, you know, of course, most notably, shout out to Exhibit who, you know, came in on the surprise tip with our guest Rashidi a couple months ago from Hip Hop Uncovered when he called in, and we had to just give him his flowers for what he did with the foundation. And, of course, we can't forget Ed OG of the Bulldogs, Be a Father to Your Child, you know, you know, if, you know, from his debut, you know, Life of a Kid in the Ghetto. You know, one thing about us guys, a lot of times, you know, black men, we get so much negative press about not being there, about being absent, you know, about being derelict, you know, irresponsible. But the truth is, and studies have shown this, there are a lot more black men involved in their children's lives than, you know, the media or press, you know, a lot of people would give credit for, you know, and there are other things. And there's things that goes on in the hood, you know, we don't want to get too political about in terms of, you know, public housing, about how men weren't allowed in the house. That kind of, unfortunately, you know, was the impetus for a lot of what was going on, you know, what happened. But it is important in terms of, especially in these times, I mean, look, it's a lot of stuff that's going on out there. And, you know, I mean, of course, Trey's mother said it in Boys in the Hood, you know, and, it, you know, and we say this, you know, being real, you know, like she said, you know, I can't teach, when she was talking to Sirius, she's like, I can't teach him how to be a man. Only you can do that.
Right.
You know?
100%.
And, pretty much when you look at the area of what's been going on, man, because obviously we got a lot going on in society. You know, we've had, you know, kids getting out there in the streets, you know, all types of violence, you know, police brutality and everything. And just a lot of – how important is it just in terms of the black family to where that that structure, that bond, that trust, that devotion, that dedication is in terms of maintaining our community and facilitating being, you know, that fulcrum, you know, in the collective village of all of us people of color?
Well, it's extremely important. You know, it's, man, it's the difference between making a left and making a right. You know, it's that simple. You know what I mean? It doesn't mean every story is going to be the same. You know, I got a younger brother who, I got two brothers. I'm the oldest. I got two younger brothers. One of them is always, you know, caught up in something. He's in the joint right now. He grew up with the same father I grew up with. You know what I mean? So it's not 100% going to be across the board, but you have a better shot and a better chance of things going the right way if you have both parents in the house and if you have some guidance and structure and all those types of things. You know, you have a better shot at it working. You know, like I said, one of my younger brothers, he's literally in the joint as we speak. But, you know, you have a better shot. You know, all of my friends in my neighborhood that lived up the block and across the street and next door and all that, they didn't have their fathers. You know, for the most part, it was one father across the street or one around the corner, and that was it. You know, everybody else, you know, it was just them and their mothers, you know. And that story gets deep, like you said, about, you know, the black man not being allowed in the house and separate and, you know, keeping us in the field and keeping the mother in the house. Like, you know, that goes way back. This was all implemented. This was planned. You know, this isn't happenstance and, oh, snap. Can't believe that happened. It happened over here too. It happened over there too. No, this was set up. You know, this was designed. But in light of that, we got to know that and just move forward and do better. And like you said, a lot of the records that are in hip-hop about fatherhood, they're talking about one side of it, which is a very real side. You know, Ed OG's record, that's a classic, and it's a very real side. And it's important because you're telling dudes, yo, man, be a father to your child. Stop playing around. You know, that's extremely important. And then on the other side, there's records like what I made where I'm saying, yo, man, I had my dad my whole life. I still got my dad. My son is always going to have me as long as I'm on this earth, God willing. You know, like, those guys are important as well because those guys exist. Everybody listening to hip-hop isn't a deadbeat dad. Everybody rapping didn't grow up with just a mom. That's impossible. You know what I mean? But
right.
For whatever reason, that's what we put the light on because it's cooler. It's cooler to be like, yo, I had it hard. I'm from the street. I ain't have my father. I only had my mother, and it was just us. It's sexier, right? Like, it sounds better. I grew up in the street, you know. My dad was a street guy, 100%. You know, got all kind of stories attached to his name. But he was there every day for me, you know, and I never wanted for anything. We wasn't rich by any means, but I ain't want for nothing because he always provided, whether it was making sure food was on the table or making sure advice was given or making sure, you know, a stern hand was there, you know. But it didn't make me any less cool or any less street. I still was outside. I still was with my friends. I still was running around. I still had all the girls, and I still would scrap if my friends were scrapping. So it didn't make me any less anything else. You know, it taught me how to have a better and easier road as an adult in life because I had somebody to show me what was what and what wasn't. That's it.
Yeah, I think it's also a case of, I think it's also a case of where they don't want to showcase strong fatherhood is because at the end of the day, our people, especially our people, we always been under attack from society, and they figure that's the most vulnerable place to attack somebody when they don't have a father.
Right. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. You know, one thing we wanted to also, too, because we're going to cover a whole bunch of topics tonight, Scott. One thing about it, what you said so poignantly, is about street culture in terms of, you know, how it's become so pervasive with a lot of the youth out there getting caught up in a lot of these things because, you know, we're all older. So we understand, you know, we've seen the shift in terms of when crack hit to when, you know, the tools started getting used. And, you know, we all came up in an era where, you know, if you had a burner on you, the burner didn't come out unless it was some real beef you had to cook, and that was something that was rare. But now it's like we see a situation with so many, you know, young people getting out there in the street and playing around with fire that they don't understand how bad it's going to burn them. What do you think is going on right now in terms of how things have changed, especially with social media playing a part of it?
Yeah, I mean, social media is huge because it does so much good for us, but then it does so much damage, and I honestly think it does more damage than good. You know, mm-hmm. Everything is a show now. Everything is, I got to let heads see it. I got to let heads know. It ain't real unless it's caught on camera. You know, I look at things that happen in the street. You can just be living your life and see something happen. I never think to pull my phone out and film it because my mind doesn't go there because I'm not from that generation. I got an iPhone. I can film everything. My mind never goes, yo, some people scrapping. Let me film it. Yo, somebody just fell down the stairs. Let me film it. My mind just doesn't go there. You know, like, I'm not of that era. You know, I'm an 80s baby, 90s raising. So, like, my mind don't go there. You know, but these kids, it does. Instead of helping out the lady who just fell down the stairs, they film it because it could go viral and get them on World Star. Yeah, but that's a whole different conversation. You know, as far as, you know, gun violence in our country, especially in New York, you know, it's on a super uptick. It feels like the 90s all over again. I think that's for a lot of reasons, you know. The restraints of COVID being locked in, you know, when you let people, it's just like in the summer, when the summer get hot, you know, it's hot outside, it's more activity going on. Well, everybody's outside now. Everybody's been cooped up in the house for so long. All this energy is out there of, yo, who you looking at, man? We crossing paths and then boom, you know, and it's just, I think COVID had a lot to do with that. People just being confined and restricted for so long. Then also, you know, the energy of the city changing so much. It seems like certain places and certain people may have let their guard down. So guys that want to get busy, you know, now they feel that there's more of a lane to get busy. There's a lot of things. There's a lot of things that line all that up. But, you know, and it's just a different generation where, you know, you got kids, you know, clapping each other and then putting it on record and then clapping back and putting it on record. You know, it's wild. It's a wild time.
And you mentioned COVID too, man. I mean, how has it affected? How has it affected how you move?
Oh man, I mean, I got a family at home. You know, I got a 3-year-old son, so I got the vaccine, but I move as if I don't have it. You know what I mean? Like I'm masked up every day. If we're talking literally how I move with COVID, I'm masked up every day. I'm sanitized every 5 minutes, and I got the shot, you know, but I move as if I don't because I got a son at home who's 3, and he not going to get the shot. I'm not giving it to him yet anyway. If my arm fall off, it's cool, you know what I mean? But I can't have his arm fall off, you know what I mean? So, you know,
right.
COVID just changed. It changed the world, as we all know. I think that's beating a dead horse. You know, COVID changed the world, and, you know, it's something we've all just, I guess, grown to live with and live by and live in spite of, you know, but you got to do so intelligently. As far as from a business standpoint, it changed a lot because, you know, I wasn't able to go on tour all of last year, and I had like 3-4 tours set up overseas, Europe, Africa, et cetera, et cetera. Wasn't able to do that, and that's fine, safety first. But, you know, it just changed the way we move. It changed the way the industry moves, the way money is made in the industry. It's a whole different ballgame.
Definitely. And one thing about it, I mean, before the tours, you know, before the music and everything, I guess we got to go ahead and give everybody a refresher in terms of, you know, how, you know, Sky, you know, which is part of your middle name, became the legendary, you know, Sky Zoo the writer. Tell us about your journey from hip-hop, from where, you know, you was young growing up in Brooklyn to, you know, now in terms of, because your credentials done are ridiculous in terms of the,
thank you.
Oh, I mean, Lloyd Banks, I mean, Black Thought, of course, the Bell Brothers with Torre. I mean, dog, your resume is unbelievable. And, I mean, we can't forget the joint you did with Illmind. I have that, too.
I'm with Illmind. I'm with Apollo Brown. Yeah, I'm with Pete Rock. You know, the list goes on and on, man. And it's a blessing. It's not a flex. It's a blessing, you know. But
yeah,
as far as my journey, you know, from the beginning, how I started, oh, man, you know, like you said, I got my name from the group Sky, you know, the Brooklyn Disco group. You know, they had a song called Sky Zoo. And as a little kid, you know, my family used to call me that as a nickname because my real name is Skyler. So, you know, it kind of played off. It was a play on words. And that was kind of just like the joking nickname in the house. Every once in a while I would hear it. And then when I started to rap, I was 9 years old when I started rapping. And when I picked the name, I knew nobody would have that name, you know, and I just ran with that. Started rapping because of Chi Ali, you know, Chi Ali from the Native Tongues Movement. Man, I was 9 years old. He was about 14, 15, and I remember just seeing the video on a video music box that AJ Ain't Nothing But a Number, you know, right in New York. Of course, if you're from New York, you know it. And when I saw the video, I was floored, and I said, man, that's what I want to do with the rest of my life. And that's what I wound up doing. I never looked back, you know, and I started writing my little rhymes in my rhyme book and, you know, just the, you know, the very early days, like the classic stories that you hear, just everywhere with my book and writing every day and every night and falling asleep with my book on my chest and, you know, just the typical stuff of just falling in love with this thing called hip-hop. And, you know, from there, I just, you know, as a teenager in high school, I was just killing everybody with the battles and the rhymes, and in college, the same thing. And that's when I really started to try to turn this thing into my career. I always wanted it as a career, but it was different from nowadays. You know, nowadays a little 14-year-old could get on his computer or his mother's computer, open up GarageBand and record something. You know, it wasn't like that. We didn't have that. You know, you had to really go to a studio or you recorded at your man's house with the microphone that came with the Techniques and it was a bad microphone. You know, like you recorded directly into a cassette tape. Like that was our era, you know, mid, late 90s. And, you know, the first time I went into a studio, I was like 15, and it was because I won a talent show. Like, you had to have a connect to get studio.
Right.
You couldn't just, you know, you had to know somebody who knew somebody to put you in a studio for an hour for $60. You know, it was different. So I didn't really start recording for real until I was like 18. You know, I'm in college. I got my own little money now. I'm doing my thing. I got little jobs and little side hustles and outside and whatever. So I'm able to, you know, pay for studio time. So I started recording at 18, 19 years old and, you know, really just building and getting my thing together, local mixtapes. I guess by the time I was about 20, 24, something like that, was when things really started taking off. 2006, when things really started taking off from a business standpoint, being able to make money off the art. And I never looked back. You know, I haven't had a quote-unquote job, 9-to-5, I should say, because my career is my job. But I haven't had a 9-to-5 in 15 years. Yeah, it's just been straight music. And I live well. You know, I live the way I want to live off my music.
And you know one thing about it too, Chad.
What made me introduce to your music was when you started working with the Justice League, and they stay out here in the Carolinas. So how did you connect with them?
Oh man, I met them in 2004. I met Sean Don in New York, and then he took my music to North Carolina. And early 2005, they invited me to come down to North Carolina just to do some studio work. And I went down for a week. You know, I called out of work for a week, and I went down there, and I just recorded. I slept at Sean Don's house on the floor. You know, him and Crisis was living together. I slept on the floor, and I just recorded. I did 15 songs in a week. And it was beats from Crisis and Ninth and For 10. And this dude who Crisis put me on to, who I had never heard of, named Ill Mind. And that was how him and I got started. You know, I met him through Crisis. Crisis was like, yo, you got to check out this Asian kid, Ill Mind. He's crazy, man. That word, and he put us in touch, and you know, we started rocking. But I got with the Justice League through Sean Don. So shout out to my man Dunny, right down there in North Carolina. And from there it was just on, you know. And then we got really close, and especially me and Ninth. You know, me and Ninth got really close, and we started doing a bunch of work. And then I want to say 2008, early 2009, something like that. He asked me to be the first artist on Jamla. He was like, I'm getting ready to start a record label called Jamla, and I would love for you to be the first artist to kick it off. You know, I got a couple artists already signed to me, but you already popping. So if I launch the label with you and you popping, you know, it's easier for me to get the label off the ground. And I said, man, done deal. You know, you my bros. It's nothing. And he said, yeah, you know, I want it to be like a Biggie and Puffy thing. I said, yeah, let's do it, you know. And that was kind of how that got started. So I wound up becoming the first artist on Jamla, dropping the first album on Jamla ever, which was The Salvation in 2009. And that was it. You know, we just started running. I started running and doing my thing.
Definitely. And one thing too, Sky, you know, when I first, you know, my first introduction came to you off of, you know, the, you know, of course, the duet you did, you know, with Torre, Get It Done. I mean, God, I mean, a premiere beat and y'all rap it. I mean, your first verse, you know what I'm saying? That dude with the fitted to the left, I'm right back at it. I ain't lost a step right through the ceiling. I ain't lost a rep. I ran 100 laps and ain't lost a breath. So fuck whoever's next. Young and I'm the moment ahead, and may God help you, because you're going to get to know that man. Son, I'm past what your aim is. Fuck around and try to get famous, and you'll be slap boxing the stainless. And all that ain't tough talk. Do this live. I'm from the block where the king was even moving 2 for 5. Doing the legacy of B.I.G. I'm on my B.I. lean. I treat beats like P.Y.C.'s. I was like, dude. And I was like,
wow.
I mean, son,
oh,
I mean.
Thank you, man. You remember the verse better than me.
Dude, and also, too, shout out to XXL, because I was trying to find my room is like a beautiful mess of just hip-hop memorabilia, because I, between the CDs, and actually, because I got to send King this to send to you, or I can send it to you on IGDM, you know, T-Max and DA, so you know it's me. I actually got the picture from when XXL profiled you some years back, you know, when you were in the store.
Yeah, definitely. Yep. Yeah, I still got that for sure. Yeah, I was in the corner store in my neighborhood. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yep, I still got that.
Yeah, man, I mean,
of hip-hop.
Yeah, man, what was it like, you know, when you really started getting your name out there in terms of, like, because I have The Salvation, you know, I got, you know, it. I mean, of course, and before I go further, I got to shout out Canada, Usual Suspects. You know, they were on with us a week ago, you know, and, you know, of course, you know, Illmind, he's from Canada, you know, I mean, so the connect is there.
You said
Illmind? Yeah.
No, Illmind's from Jersey.
Okay, Jersey. I keep thinking, I thought he was from Canada. Okay, my bad, my bad. Even
nah,
I
yeah, he's from Jersey.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, man, but, I mean, what was it like in terms of, like, you, like, just really beginning to, like, you know, I mean, Double XL is huge. I mean, you're hooking up with, like, you know, Justice League, you know, Knife Wonder, Illmind, I mean, and you're really getting your name out there. What is it like, you know, when you're really starting getting this press? When did you realize that the thing was, like, you know, like, these prestigious hip-hop publications and word of mouth is spreading about how dope this kid from Brooklyn is?
Well, I think as an up-and-coming artist, those are the things you strive for. You know, you're getting your name known, you're buzzing. And, man, again, when I did the Double XL thing 2006, I still had a job. I had to call out of work for that. You know what I mean? Like, I had to, same way I had to call out of work to go to North Carolina in 2005 for a week. I had to call out of work. Like, yo, I need the day off tomorrow. I got to do a photo shoot for Double XL. And my boss is like, what? Like, because, you know, my boss was young and, you know, was new hip-hop and all that. My boss was like, what? Like, for real? You know what I mean? So, you know, I was young, man. I was, you know, 22, 23, whatever it was. I was young. And but it's a good feeling. It lets you know you're going in the right direction. You know, those things shouldn't define you. I think we live in an era where kids let that stuff define them, so they feel like if they don't get it, it means, you know, they don't mean anything. And if they don't get it, they're not worthy. That's untrue.
Right.
But at the same time, it's just another testament to let you know you're going in the right direction, and it's more proof to just let you know to keep going. So, you know, man, it was that, and it was the soil. It was a million things, man. We could say all day, you know, running down the line of those types of things. But, you know, it was a blessing always.
Mm-hmm.
And what people don't realize also is that Double XL period, which is like I was saying earlier, that was like, if you follow sports, that was like looking at the Slam magazine, like who the up and comer.
Right. 100%. No, 100%, it had all that value to it.
Definitely. You know, and one thing about it, Sky, you know, and that's the perfect segue, because on Off the Cuff, we can go from so many different things, from music to wrestling to cooking. I mean, we do it all on this show. King of myself, we're just the mad scientist, super chefs up in here. King mentioned Slam magazine. Tell us what it was like when you started doing that blog in terms of you doing your contributions in terms, because we know you're a diehard New York Knicks fan. What was that like in terms of getting the pen, you know, from, you know, emceeing on one side, but also getting to write your thoughts about what was going on in basketball culture as well?
Oh, it was dope, you know, just because basketball is another love of mine, totally outside of music. And, you know, I'm a typical, when it comes to sports, I'm a typical guy. You know, I'm ESPN all day, 24/7, sit down, crack a beer, eat some wings, and watch sports all day. Like, I'm, when the music's not on, I'm a typical guy in that regard. You know, like, I'm sports all day. So, you know, it was dope to have them approach me about doing that. They came to me and asked if I wanted to do that because they heard all the basketball references and all of my music and was like, damn, he really knows what he's talking about, you know. So, you know, that was dope. It was just cool to flex the pen in another realm with a sport that I love.
Definitely, man. And, you know, one thing about it, it's always been an intrinsic link between, you know, sports and hip-hop, and especially the Mecca, you know, New York, you know, and which, you know, and, I mean, the basketball culture. I mean, you know, from Coney Island, you know, where Stephon Marbury comes from, you know, I mean, you know, just one of the more, just, I mean, the notables. I mean, Bernard King coming from NY, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you know.
Bernard King, one of the toughest Knickerbockers ever.
Yeah, man. I mean, Mark Jackson, you know what I'm saying? It's, you know, the legacy is so deep in terms of it because it's rooted at so many different levels. You know, Ron Artest coming from QB. You know, what does New York, what is it about, you know, the Big East, you know, New York, that just brings just such a defining lore in terms of sports and hip-hop, in terms of how so many people are just identified from it, you know, in terms of it's synonymous. You know, what is it about the city that just makes it fame, you know, just so renowned in that regard?
Yeah, well, New York is a basketball city. I think it's the most basketball city out of anywhere in the world. You know, there's always the argument of where do the best basketball players come from. And that's cool because, you know, there's a million of them out of L.A. and there's a million of them out of the South. You know, y'all got a ton of them. You know, I think as far as the amount of players that come out of New York and make it pro, we've kind of lost that number because all the kids in New York now, they either want to be scammers or they want to rap, you know, so they're not really following through on it, you know, AAUs and, you know, ABDC camps and all, like, they're not following through on it like they used to, but we still are a city that's all about basketball, you know, so even if we're not producing players making it to the league, all we talk about is ball. All we watch is ball. It's the most popular sport. And there's literally a basketball court on every single corner in New York City. And there's also somebody parked in front of that basketball court blasting hip-hop out of their speakers on every single corner in New York City. So the two go hand in hand. You know, the first time I heard Illmatic, which is my favorite hip-hop album of all time, I don't think there's a better hip-hop album existing, the first time I heard it was on a basketball court. I was on a basketball court. 12 years old playing ball in Brooklyn, and the OG Hustlers was parked in front of the park drinking Henny, shooting dice, and playing Nas, you know, with the windows down. And that was the first time I heard Illmatic, cover to cover, A to Z. The whole thing was playing while we was playing 3-on-3. And I was like, yo, I got to go get that tape when I get off the court. And that's what happened. You know, I was 12 years old. You know, that's New York.
Man, I mean, you know, April 19th, 1994. Was, you know, because Nas's legend had already started. You know, shout out to Nas. You know, the whole QB, Black Poet, Trag, Gaddafi, Capone, Noriega, you know, Mobb Deep, Prodigy, rest in peace, Lakey the Kid, so many, 41st Side North, 41st Side South, so many legends. You know, Infamous Mob, Big Twins, goddamn, we could go all day. But yeah, man. But Nas's legend started, you know, of course, on Main Source's, you know, Breaking Out of the album, you know, in 1990, and of course, 1992 off the Zebrahead soundtrack, you know, with Halftime. And then, of course, you fast forward to the 94, of course, starts with It Ain't Hard to Tell, which was the official lead single, you know, for what Illmatic was coming, man. I mean, when you heard Illmatic, what was, because this, you're not the only one, Scott, that pretty much gives that album the distinction of being the greatest ever hip-hop album. The Source, when they reviewed it, writers said, this is simply one of the greatest hip-hop albums I've ever heard, period. You know, what do you think, why do you think that album still resonates so much in hip-hop culture 27 years after its release?
I think it's because it defines hip-hop. It embodies what hip-hop is, from the lyricism to the production, to the storytelling, to just the way it's all woven together. The picture that it's painting is what we know of hip-hop to be, in a sense of why hip-hop started. You know, the creation of hip-hop and how hip-hop started is all these things that this album represents. You know, coming out of the projects, kind of having little to nothing to go off of, kind of making something out of nothing. These are the things that hip-hop was built on. And that album speaks on that environment and talks about all of those things. So I think that's why it connects, as well as the fact that, you know, the lyricism and the storytelling and the production is so great. And it's just a great mixture and a great smorgasbord of all of that.
I think what made Illmatic so great, too, was that was probably the first album that had, like, a all-star cast of producers. It was like a movie orchestra in a way. Like, you had Premier, you had
L.E.S.,
you had Pete Rock,
Lost Professor, yeah.
Because everybody before had, like, one producer doing all the albums. I think that's where another reason why that changed the culture.
Yeah. And when you're looking at it, Scott, too, Illmatic was really, you know, 94, because, you know, when you said you started picking up the pen at 9 years old, your journey, your foray into the hip-hop game in terms of being a serious writer, your age really coincides in terms of where at that time coincided with the golden era, you know, 87, 88. So we're looking at Public Enemy, we're looking at X-Clan, Queen Latifah, MC Light, LL. You know, going into the 90s, of course, N.W.A., Ice Cube, Compton's Most Wanted, DJ Quick, you know, and going further, of course, you know, Nas, you know, Artifacts, you know, even, you know, some kid from Marcy that was just kind of coming out there, you know, by the name of Jay-Z, I think you heard of him, you know, with of course, with Hawaiian Sophie in 88 with Big Jazz with Original Flavor, Can I Get Open, off of their Beyond Flavor album in 1994. Biggie, of course, we can't forget him, and we can't forget Wu-Tang. So we're seeing all of these golden eras of hip-hop, you know, just coming together at the time. What was New York like at that time growing up in terms of seeing, like, did you all know the movement of what was happening with all these artists? Because I'm sure you saw a lot of these people before they became big. You know, did you all know at that time what it was going to be like in terms of these people you would see around the way they were going to end up becoming legendary?
Well, me personally, I didn't see a lot of them because I was a kid, you know. I was born in 82, so I was a kid, you know. But, you know, I grew up the block from Biggie, so that's the one person who I did see all the time, you know. That's the one person who I was like, man, like, he's on TV, he's on the radio, he's popping now. I remember when he used to be on the block hanging out in front of the liquor store or hanging out on the step or at the corner store. Like, I remember that, and now he's popping. But, again, I was a little kid. I was 11, 12 years old, and he was 20, 21. So it's not like I was hanging out with him. I would just see him in the neighborhood as one of the OGs, you know. But just the feeling of that time period was amazing. It's something that is reflected in my music, you know. That feeling of that time period was so incredible, you know, just the way the music was being pumped out and what it sounded like. And, you know, New York really was running the scene, and you had a lot of music coming from other places. But I used to go to South Carolina every summer as a kid because my family background is from South Carolina. So I would go to South Carolina every summer as a kid, and all of my cousins and everybody down there, kids, they was all about what was happening in New York with the music scene. You know, it was all about, yo, what's up with the Wu-Tang? Yo, what's up with this? What's up with that? Like, I used to bring tapes of videos down south around the neighborhood, like in Menace to Society. You know, I would tape Rap City or Video Music Box and bring it with me to South Carolina. And that one videotape would last for 2 months, and it would get passed around the neighborhood, you know, of just New York City hip-hop videos. That's how strong the culture was at the time for us.
Man, you know, and when you think about it too, man, when you talk about a Video Music Box in terms of video cassettes, of course, you know, the nostalgia. I mean, shout out to OC, you know, I mean, just, you know, as well, who's part of that golden era, who's a guest on our show. It's funny, man, because when we look at it from how it was, you know, like the Wu-Tang said, can it be all so simple? You know, and a lot of youngins really are not going to understand this in terms of, like, having your tape deck waiting, you know, the tissue and the tape, you know, waiting with the pause button, you know, waiting to let it go. When your favorite song come on the radio, and then, of course, with the Video Music Box, you're on TV Raps, you know, Rap City, and, like, you got the videotape and the VCR. If you were really dope with it, you could program it to come one at a time. And, I mean, just really, like, it was just, I mean, one thing about it, just the videos and just how the music was marketed back then, you know, it's not like it is now where it became corporate. I mean, you know, from your years of listening and being in the business, you know, because you went from, you know, novice to, you know, you went from novice student to paid professional to burgeoning legend. So you've seen the transitions from all those eras. How have you seen the change in terms of how music is marketed to where it's played and just, you know, all of that?
Oh, well, you know, we saw the change from how it really took off as far as going mainstream and really being marketed in a different light and all that stuff. I feel like it was about 97. And it was a beautiful thing because that's what we wanted. You know, in hip-hop, we wanted to be taken seriously. You're talking about an art form that people said would be dead in 5 years. People said, oh, that's not going to last. That's not real music. They're not singing. You know, they're just talking over beats, and it's loud and noisy. So 5 years, it'll be gone. Well, now we're looking at, you know, what, 35, 40 years or whatever it might be. We're looking at all that. And, you know, we've proven it wrong. And we wanted to be taken seriously. You know, we wanted the endorsement dollars. We wanted our music and TV shows and movies and for us to run the table and run the situation. And that happened. I think it happened in 97. people don't want to believe it or not, but it happened with Puff and the Bad Boy movement, which was a humongous part of my upbringing. You know, I grew up the block from Biggie, so I'm a Bad Boy kid by default, bottom line. You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't let people say nothing bad about Bad Boy. I don't care how much Dilla and Knife and whatever people know me for. You can't say nothing about Bad Boy around me. They raised me. You know what I mean? So I grew up on Biggie block, so they raised me. So, you know, when Puff came out in 97 and he made everything a little happier and a little more fun and a little more digestible and really got to the money, it opened up the world. It opened up corporate America to say, yeah, now we want to get involved with that. They're not shooting and killing each other. They're not in every video pouring out a 40 with Tim's and jeans on. Now we'll get behind that and put some money behind it. And it's the reason why Jay-Z's a billionaire and Puff's a billionaire and Dr. Dre's a billionaire. Those things don't happen if 97 doesn't happen. If we're being honest, you know, we got to give it up where it's due. So the shift started around then, and it was a great thing. But then a lot of other things came with it that weren't so great as well, because it just was overkill. It just, people went a little too crazy with letting corporate America tell us what's what for the dollar, you know. And usually the one with the dollar is the one who got the power. So it kind of went haywire. But being marketed and everything the way it needed to be, I feel like 97 is what shifted it all and changed it.
You know, Sky, and it's crazy because when I think about that era, because, of course, for our heads, because we're really going to go DITC, you know, digging in the crate. I remember, of course, if you know, for those for my heads out there that really remember, King knows this as well. Who's the Man soundtrack, 1992, Biggie's Party and Bullshit. And, you know, it started really catching, you know, radio play, at least out in this area. I'm in Hampton Roads, Virginia. We started, you know, hearing that around maybe early 1993, summer of 93. And then, of course, you know, the Supercat Dolly My Baby remix with Big and Puff on it. And it's like, because mind you, we still didn't have an idea of who those guys really were. Outside, they were just making banging-ass music. I mean, the Supercat Dolly My Baby remix was just rocking all summer that year. You know, but I mean, but Biggie's verse of these, I love it when you call me Big Papa, the showstopper, the rock dropper. I'm like, yo.
Yeah.
I was like, yo, who is this kid right here? You know, he's got.
You know what
I mean,
was about the 90s, too, was that it set the ball. It set the ball to another level on rhyme skill. Like, we've seen it in the 80s, and the 90s just set it to a different bar in terms of skill level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it was just like Sky mentioned earlier when he heard Nas playing on the basketball court. Nas made people thinking they want to pick up the microphone and rap, but at the same time can't do it like him, so it made them kind of like scared to really pick it up. They were like, nah, I can't rap with these dudes. I can't rap with a pun. I can't rap with a DMX. I got to just play the sidelines. But it seemed like today it's easy to, it's like you inspired to pick up a mic now. It's easier.
Yeah, no, 100%.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, even Nas said himself, you know, I was, you know, kicked my little routes because I thought niggas wouldn't understand. And now in every jam, I'm the fucking man. I rap in front of more niggas than in the slave ships. I used to watch chips. Now I load Glock clips. I got to have it. Miss Mr. Magic, versatile. My style switches like a faggot, but not bisexual. I'm an intellectual in rapping. I'm professional, and that's no question, yo. I'm like,
he was just a baby. He was just in his 20s.
Yeah.
That's the cold part.
When you really got in, what was it like, Guy, in terms of when you really started rhyming, in terms of like getting, you know, counting, in terms of learning all the nuances? Because, of course, the fundamentals is rhyming the words. When you get into the more advanced parts of, you know, counting your bars, you know, understanding, you know, your bass, you know, your drum rhythm patterns in terms of your, you know, your two twos, you know, your three fours, all of that in terms of catching the beat and everything, you know, ad libs. What was it like in terms of that process of really, really like, because once you committed it to it, you know, obviously we got you on today as a testament to the living proof of the dopeness that you came with. What was it like in those early process of just really kind of learning the craft and really getting good at it?
Well, just being a student of the game. You know, before I started rapping, I was listening to hip-hop all day because I had young parents, and that's what they was listening to in the car and in the house and all that. than I grew up in the building where you look out the window, everybody's playing hip-hop, and, you know, the staircase next to the door, you know, I lived on the 18th floor in the P's, you know, in the PJs. So, you know, if you – the staircase was right next to our door. So the kids would be – when I say kids, I mean like 17, 18, 19-year-olds would be in the staircase blowing weed and listening to hip-hop, you know, and all of that would seep under the door into my house. You know what I mean? So it was just the norm, you know. And just being a student of the game, you know, being a student of the game, listening to everything, really learning and studying. And I wasn't really going out there to study. I wasn't like, man, I got to listen to so-and-so to learn how to do this and learn how to do that. I just was listening to hip-hop all day, every day. So then when I made hip-hop, it was in me. You watch Jordan play all day, every day, or Kobe play all day, every day, you're going to shoot like him. When you go on the court, you're going to shoot like him. Your form going to be like him. Your handle going to be like him. It's just what it is. It's science, you know. It's just a part of it. So that was, you know, how that all came together. And I just went hard at it. And it was just something I loved. The love pushed it. You know, I didn't want to do nothing else but make music. I didn't want to do nothing else but rap 24/7 as a little 13-year-old kid. And, you know, it just stayed that way for a couple decades now. That was it.
Man, you know, and to see the music, you know, like Nate Dogg dropped his, you know, album Music and Me, you know, it's something that, you know, to hear the love, such the appreciation, you know, the devotion, you know, for the culture is so profound because, you know, for the years that you've put into this, you know, already you're becoming, well, you are an OG in the game in terms of really carrying on tradition and passing that down to the next generation of artists. You know, when you talk to a lot of artists in the game, you know, a lot of younger guys coming in terms of giving them wisdom, dropping jewels of knowledge, and just giving them the proper guidance, what do you tell them, and just what have you seen how the game has changed now with a lot of young artists coming in?
I always tell them to remember that this is a business first. You know, the business side of it can easily deter you from why you're doing it in the first place or what you loved about it in the first place. I always tell people, man, remember that it's a business first and understand the way this thing moves, because if you don't love it, it'll tear you apart. So remember that it's a business first, but the love is what's going to push you through. So if you don't love making music, just get out of it, because what happens is if you're in it just for the money or just for this or that, you get into the business side, and in 3-4 months, you could be over. Yeah. You'd be like, yo, I'm out of here. Like, I don't want to do this no more. But if you love it, the love will push you through and make you want to continue to do it forever in spite of what happens with the business, in spite of the nonsense. It'll be like, all right, word. Yeah, I'm on that. So, you know, I always tell people, remember it's the business first, but you got to have the love and the passion for it to push you through and do it for the right reasons. You know, we all here to make money. We all here to get paid. But do it for the right reasons, and I promise all that will come with it.
Yeah, you know, and that's something I think a lot of artists have to understand, because, you know, when you look at a lot of these artists who've had meltdowns over the years, and on Off the Cuff Radio, we just keep it raw and uncut, but we're never out to shade or, you know, tell lies or, you know, diss anybody. We just, King and myself, we pride ourselves on being journalists to the best of our ability in terms of representing this brand, our show, and respecting our guests. And, you know, what you said, Sky, about, you know, how the music, how the business can frustrate you. I mean, remember when Lil Uzi Vert was talking a couple of years ago about how he didn't want to rap anymore? He was like just fed up with the business and everything, you know. And it's like, you know, I'm like, damn, Uzi. He had a way, but it's like obviously something in the game, you know, was just got under his skin about it. And he's not the first to say, you know, fuck this industry, you know what I'm saying? You know, but it's something where I think a lot of times people, you know, because we all come up in an era where when you heard, you know, if you got paid back in the day, it was good, you know, it was great, but you really were making music about representing your block, whether you were from the East Coast or the West Coast. So the pay was just a, you know, bonus, but it was really about getting your shit out there for people to listen to and really rock with you, because, you know, if you had that respect from people respecting, you know, your craft and what you put into it, that was worth more than a million. You know, You know what I mean? Could you imagine what it would have been like back in the day if we had Twitter and YouTube and Facebook and IG during them days? Man, can you imagine
that? Yeah, for real. For real.
Yeah, man. So, let's talk about some of your collabs. I'm going to throw out some names at you, and you tell us how that came out there. Lloyd Banks, how did that come about?
That was, so I had a record, Speakers on Blast, and it was doing really, really well, in New York on the radio and kind of everywhere. Like, it was really starting to bubble and go crazy. That was me and Illmind. And it was just a really, really powerful single as far as, like, being an MC and a lyricist and being quote-unquote underground. I hate the title, but having a radio banger, having a hit, like having a record that, I mean, Hot 97 was playing it every single day, DJ Enough and all those guys, and DJ Self and Power 105 was playing it every single day. It was getting spins in other cities across the country, mix show and rotation. It was crazy. Like, it was really wild. You know, you could go outside in the summertime and that record would be playing in people's cars. So the record got really hot, and a lot of people wanted to jump on the remix. And there was other people who asked about jumping on it. Banks was one of the ones who, how we got in touch with Banks. Me and him the same age, so it's the same generation and kind of the same, the same cloth. And we're both lyricists and both New York and all that type of stuff. And then I was on the phone with 50 Cent for a while. Me and 50 was building for like an hour and a half about some stuff. And he asked about the remix, and, I told him that, Banks was getting on it, and he was like, yeah, I'm definitely going to make sure that happens, and, it's all love. We supporting it, whatever you need. And, Banks wound up doing the joint a couple of days later, and it was super dope. Like I said, we the same age, same generation, same era, and we both, monster lyricists, so it all just made sense.
Okay. Jadakiss, how did that happen?
Oh, man, the Lox is my favorite group of all time. I grew up on the Lox, and the way I got with Jada kind of just was just, like, through the industry, when you get on, the people that you grew up listening to are now your homies and your contemporaries and guys that you cross paths with at industry events and guys who know who you are, So
right.
I wound up getting with Jada just because, I would see him out and about at different events and things like that over the years, and he knew who I was. Yo, Skyzoo, you doing your thing. You killing him out here. I see you. My ears to the street. Stuff like that. And we got cool on that level. And he was like, yo, if you ever need anything, hit me. Him, Style, Sheik, all of them. Like, yo, if you ever need anything, hit me. And switching info. And then I had a record. I was like, yo, I got something for us, bro. If you with it, I got it. And he was like, yeah, absolutely. So I went up to Yonkers to the Lox studio, I was up there for a while just kicking it with them and building. And I had the record. I was like, yo, this the one I got in mind. And he was like, hell yeah, I'm with it, and he knocked it out, and it came out crazy. Same thing with Styles. Me and Styles got two records together. Styles is big bro, so it's all love. Like I said, the guys you grew up listening to, they become fans of your music when you get on. So now those is your homies. Same thing with Black Thought, who you might ask about next, same thing. I met Black Thought through just being in the industry. The Roots used to do this thing in New York. Every week they would perform at a spot called Highline Ballroom. They would do a live performance, and they would have artists come through and rock. And one day he texted me, yo, we doing our Roots joint tomorrow night. Can you come through? I was like, yeah. And I went through and, jumped on stage and performed with Black Thought, freestyling and all that. And, we always just kept tight. We always just kept in touch, man. You know what I'm saying? And, when it was time, I reached out. I was like, yo, I got a joint, man. That makes sense. And he was like, yeah, send it to me. Let me know. And that was it. We rocked out.
Dr. Dre.
Oh, man, that was through, I know some of the guys over there at Aftermath, man, and I would be in L.A. doing, other work, and then I would just float through the studio and pull up over there and kick it and build and all that. And, Dre is Dre. You can't even say nothing. Anything I can say about him, you say it twice over. Dre is Dre. And he's so cool, and his knowledge of music is like nothing you've ever seen. The way he approaches making a record, from the production to the rhymes to the cadences, is like nothing you've ever seen. And the jewels I got from just being with him all the time was crazy. So it's an honor.
One thing about it, Scott, is when you look at the industry and because I was, you know, we wanted to ask those questions because a lot of times the backstory of the collaborations, because collaborations are crazy as is, but to hear the story behind it is even a deeper discussion because there's a lot that goes on because, like you said, and you articulated it so perfectly about how, you know, once you really become vested in the game, like, you have a lot of people you come up listening to, you know, who become fans of yourself. And, you know, you get to work with them. What is that like to get that type of respect from those people in terms of you're recognized not only as one of their contemporaries, but as of equal, you know, talent?
It's huge. You know, again, it's like I said earlier with the press and the media, you know, when you get that, you grow up listening to them guys. You know, I was 14 buying every DJ Clue tape there was because it always had a lock freestyle at the beginning of it, you know. So now for those guys to be my peoples and to hit them up, shoot them a text or hop on the phone or build with them, it means the world, you know. As a little, the 13-year-old, 14-year-old me goes crazy every time that happens. Like, yeah, man, word up, you know. Same thing working with Spike Lee. You know, I grew up watching Spike Lee movies. Now Spike is my homie, you know, and we kick it and we build and, you know, all that. That's my man. I did a record and he was all over the video, you know, like it, Spike Lee was my hero joint, you know, like that. That's part of what this is about. Those are the shining moments that you're excited about. Like, yeah, man, I grew up watching Spike. Now Spike is my man. That's my homie. You know, I grew up listening to the Locks and listening to the Roots and, you know, those my homies now. Like, we got records together. Like, that's what it's about. Dr. Dre, I grew up listening to Dre. Now that's my man. You know, it's huge.
Yeah, and from that level of it, you know, go ahead, King. Go ahead, King.
That's just a sign of greatness, man. You know, when you put certain things out in the universe, it just comes back forward 3 or 4 times even faster.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and the thing when you're looking at the way that you've interacted with legends, I mean, of course, with Dre, shout out to my man Del K. Edward, a contributor for Hip Hop Uncovered on FX, because, you know, we talk about it, and he, you know, everybody, you know, on this show, we've talked to so many people that have met Dre, and they say the same thing in terms of, you know, his musical genius, you know, his unbelievable attention to detail, you know, and while a lot of people have been around him, you know, and even been in the studio with him, not many people really get to sit down with him on a real level in terms of, and of course, if you do talk to Dre, tell him we really need detox in our lives. We really need that.
No
you
doubt.
Know. Yeah, man. I mean, so you've interacted with some of the legends. What's it been like getting to travel the world at some of the places you've gone? What was your first tour that you ever went on? Well, tell us about your first real paid performance.
Honestly, I don't remember my first paid performance, man. It's been so long, man.
It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but my first tour, was, I would say, yeah, the Ghostface tour. Just going on tour with Ghostface 2009 off of the Salvation. That was huge. You know, again, you grow up listening to them. Now you're touring with them. Now you're homies with them. Now you're kicking it on the tour bus and you're vibing and they're shouting you out when they're on stage. Yo, shout out to my man Sky Zoo for tearing it down just now. You know, like those, you know, young guy coming up off my first album, you know, that stuff is crucial and it means a ton. So first tour was a U.S. tour with Ghostface. A week later, I was on, was it a week? I think it was 2 days later after the tour ended, I was on another U.S. tour with Raekwon. So here we go, same thing, you know, so we did that. And then a year later, I was on the Duck Down tour with my brother Sean Price, rest in peace, Sean Price, and, you know, the whole Duck Down. And then I went overseas after that. You know, I did a European tour with my bro Torre, and it just kept going from there. And now every year, except for COVID, you know, every year I tour all year long. I go to Europe, I go to South Africa, I go to Australia, I go to Japan, and I do the U.S. every single year. You know, I do my runs, and I'm on the road half the year. You know, that's just part of my life, part of my career, and it's a blessing.
How important is
it? I didn't hear you. What's that?
I was going to say,
yeah.
Yeah, I was asking about what you were being considered doing the virtual touring, like even if they wasn't really opening things up.
Yeah, I did a virtual show a couple weeks ago, actually, off the new album. I did a virtual show, and we did like half and half. So half the venue was half the venue was open because, you know, things are kind of getting back to normal a little bit, but then the rest of the tickets was virtual, and it was really dope. You know, I had never done one before, but it was a cool vibe. It was a cool experience.
And doing tours, Sky, because it is the exercise and endurance when you're traveling the world. How important is it to maintain a very healthy routine in terms of your meditation, in terms of your exercise? You know, if you smoke a little bit of the la-la, and just making sure that your mind and body is at ease in terms of it, and not indulging yourself in anything that could, you know, be destructive to your performance or, you know, your mental, you know, stability.
It's huge. You know, it's huge because you're going out there doing that every night. So it's like playing basketball. You know, you in the NBA, you got to go out there and rock every single night. So it's huge. You know, I tour extensively, you know, to the point where everybody knows I had vocal cord surgery last summer. I had a polyp on my vocal cord from performing so much. Yeah, I didn't know you guys didn't know that. I had vocal cord surgery last summer. You know, I had a polyp on my vocal cord, similar to Adele, you know, the singer, just from touring so much. You know what I mean? So
Jeezy had that at one time, too. Yeah, Jeezy had it.
Right,
one.
You know, so it wasn't about, you know, I was taking care of my body. I just was using my voice a lot, you know. So, you know, I had vocal cord surgery, and they removed the polyp, and now I'm back to normal, and I sound back to normal, and everything is great. But, you know, it's huge. You're out there working out every single night. You know, being on stage for an hour is like playing a game, you know. It's like being on the court. You know, you're literally working out.
Yeah.
And you got to let people know how I ain't mean to cut you off, T-Mans, but I was going to ask them how.
No,
you
got to
let people know how the importance behind having a strong stage presence is, because it's like a lot of people coming in this day and age in the game, they got the studio performance on lock. It sounds good when it comes to laying down the tracks, but when they go on stage, it's just boo-boo, man. They got to bring 30 people on stage to perform. They got to have a hype man every 2 minutes. It's like the stage performance essence has just pretty much been lost in today's artists. So do you care to let people know how important that is?
Yeah, it's hugely important. You know, it can make or break a lot of things. I've seen artists with really bad records have a great stage show and people go crazy and love them, you know, and I've seen people with really great records with an awful stage show lose fans. Like, dag, the album is so crazy, but stage show was whatever. I'm not really a fan no more. You know, when you're on stage, you're bringing the album to life. You're bringing the music to life, you know, so it's extremely important.
Yeah, and it's true, Sky, like King said, because one thing about it, for all of his craziness and all of his batshit moments, I got to see Kanye West back in 2004 when he was, like, really starting out as a rapper. Nigga, I will tell you, that boy could put on a show. This was Kanye before he was Kanye now, before Kanye to have all the money. This was Kanye, college
right.
Dropout Kanye starting. Kanye rocked that shit like, I mean, the energy Ye had was just unbelievable. You know, I've seen Method Man and Redman perform twice. Those two have an unbelievable stage show. Jeezy, shout out to my folk, man, CTE. You know, Ace, Sheldon, the whole crew, DJ Teflon,
right.
Those guys. Jeezy has a great stage show in terms of really, you know, grabbing the audience's attention. In terms of everywhere you've been, how do you compare the hip-hop culture in America in terms of appreciation to what it is overseas in terms of, you know, how people really, really get they really feel it in terms of it? Because, of course, you've been to Australia, shout-out to New South Wales, Melbourne, Cleet, Kingsland, of course, Japan, Tokyo, you know, Osaka, you know, Africa, you know, Johannesburg, you know, I mean, what is it like going to those places and how those people react to it?
Man, it's amazing. It's a blessing. You know, you go to these places and some of these places don't speak the language, or they barely speak the language, or it's 50-50. And it's amazing that they connect. You know, I've done shows where people feel like they have to wear a Knick jersey when they come to the show, or they have to wear a Knick hat because they know I'm such a Knick fan. You know, that happens all the time.
Right.
They'll say, yo, I wore this Knick jersey just for you. I wore this Knick hat just for you.
Mm.
So it's huge.
Mm.
You know, that's when you
that's
connect.
Love.
That's when you connect with people. So, you know, it's a beautiful thing. You know, it's a blessing, and it's a part of why we get in this, to make this music and make it connect with people and be remembered and be up there with those guys, man. So it's huge.
So we're going to get into the basketball bag for a minute, Sky, because you're such an avid Knicks fan, you know, because you definitely want to talk a little bit of sports because you're a sports head, too. We want to try to cover as many bases as possible, you know, accommodating such a distinguished guest. Knicks have had such, you know, a tumultuous history over the past 20-plus years, of course, with, you know, coaches from Larry Brown to, you know, Lenny Wilkins, of course, with James Dolan, you know, Margaret, Isaiah Thomas. What's it been like in terms of being a fan to see them finally being able to turn the corner where you have, of course, R.J. Barrett, Julius Randle, and just seeming like they're finally coming together? How does it feel in terms of just, you know, from, because, of course, we all grew up in an era, of course, with Patrick Ewing, John Starks, Charles Smith, Anthony Mason, rest in peace, Derek Harper, you know, and just everything in between, you know, the old NBA, as we call it. What's it like for you as a fan to see the Knicks really turning the corner in the right way?
It's beautiful. It's something that we've been wanting forever. You know, if you've been a diehard Knicks fan since birth like me and you're kind of born into it, you know, it's something we've been waiting for. You ride with them through the good, you ride with them through the bad. So it's been awesome, you know, being able to root for them. Well, I always rooted for them regardless, but being able to look at them and be like, yeah, now we got something on the court that makes sense and we're not just waiting for the lottery or whatever. You know, it's been awesome, and it's just the beginning. You know, it's just the beginning, so it's good to be back in the conversation.
Yeah, I'm a diehard Bulls fan, but I respect and love basketball culture no matter, you know, what you're up. And I've always said this, in terms of the marketing for the league and just, you know, even if, you know, which is no shot, even if the Knicks haven't won in 40-some years, I'm like, if the Knicks win a championship, I'm like, this is great for the city. I'm like, this is great for the league. New York is that town. It's the media capital. You know, so anytime the Knicks do great in general, it's great for the league. So I'm happy as a fan to see,
right,
you know, y'all doing y'all thing. You know what I'm saying? Because diversification is always good, and y'all have such a proud tradition. You know, Walt Bellamy, you know, Kiki Vanderweg, of course, Dave DeBuscher, Walt Clyde Frazier, Bernard King, you know, Earl Monroe. I mean, you know, of course, can't forget Phil Jackson, you know, and Tex Winter, you know. So you all have, you know, I don't think the Knicks at times get enough credit for being, you know, basketball royalty, you know, in terms of what you all have brought to the city, you know, and how y'all still, you know, and how y'all, you know, the Knicks encompass what it means to all.
Big city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the big city's got to be.
No, I agree 100%.
The big city's got to be good and competitive. That's what's best for the league. Like, who would want to see the Knicks become good again? Who wants to see the Bulls and the Celtics and all those teams, the big city teams, that is, be good again? That's good for the league.
Right.
Yeah, man. So who do you think wins it this year?
Oh, man. I don't know. I wouldn't mind Phoenix and Atlanta just because it would be different. You know, I wouldn't mind seeing that. But I think Phoenix goes, it's going to be hard for Atlanta to get through it, you know, with Trey being banged up right now. But I wouldn't mind seeing that.
Chris Paul, look, Chris Paul, one of the greatest point guards ever. He's in my top seven, if not top five. Phoenix is moving right. Huh? What, King?
I said, I hope he gets a break.
Yeah, but Chris really deserves it. When you look at a guy who has really been through it in terms of being so close, Chris is one of those guys that you just really, you can't root against him. That man has put in so much. When you started writing for Slam, in terms of doing your blog, You know, Sky, tell us a little bit about, you know, in terms of some of the subjects you wrote on in terms of your blogs. Or were they about the game specifically, or players, or just the whole scene? Tell us about it.
It kind of was whatever I wanted to write about, you know. I haven't done it in a while. I actually don't do it anymore. But it kind of was whatever I wanted it to be about. It was pretty free-flowing. So the topics would range. I think I did one once all about point guards, you know, because I'm a big point guard guy. And, you know, so the topics would kind of range as far as it wasn't specific. It was whatever I wanted to do as long as it was about basketball and the NBA and stuff like that. So it was a lot of fun.
So there's an analogy in terms of when you do it in terms of being a point guard, because when you're an MC, especially if you're doing a collaboration, you're setting it up in terms of the format, in terms of the process of how the song flows, and then there's your transitions in terms of trade-offs, and then, you know, like a per se alley-oop or an assist, giving it, you know, to whoever you're rhyming with. What's it like in terms of writing a rhyme by yourself as opposed to writing with somebody? Like, tell us about how the Barrel Brothers collaboration with Torre came about.
Well, you know, Tor's been my brother forever. You know, we met in 2005, you know, and through that was actually through Sean Don as well, because he knew both of us and put us on the same song together. And, you know, once we realized we both was from Brooklyn, we just started hanging out. And we've been cool ever since. You know, about 16 years in, you know, we've been cool ever since. And that's family, you know. So we had done a couple records together, Click and Get It Done, and couple other things we had together, and people just was asking. People always, yo, when y'all gonna do a joint together? When y'all gonna do a joint together? And it took off, and then we sat down and decided to do it. We was like, you know what, let's give it to them. You know, we don't know if we're gonna do 2 or 3 or 10, but let's at least do one. And, you know, we did one album together. We sat down and rocked out. And it was dope because, you know, I know you asked about writing kind of together. Obviously, I'm writing all my stuff. He's writing all his stuff. But just being in the room together and having concepts and ideas and saying, okay, what if we did a record like this? What if we did a record like that? And then just having the concept. You know, we did a record called Four Bar Friday where we wrote the record together. So if I write four bars, go in the booth, spit it, then he writes four bars, go in the booth, spit it. Then I write four. So it's breaking up. You know, it's not just recording one shot. I record four, I come out. He write, record four, come out. I write four, record, come out. You know, like that. You know, so it was cool. You know, it was a cool experience.
Yeah. I remember, you know, he wrote an article that was just, because one thing about it is that, you know, when you all get to write in terms of not rhyming, I think it's just an extension of the innate talent that you already have because, and it goes back to the business aspect of what we were talking about earlier, Sky, because, of course, I read an article Tor Ray wrote about how what it was in terms of him having a job working in a bank, and then he just decided that he wanted to make music his life, but he talked about what it is in terms of the sacrifices, the grind, the commitment that it takes running your own personal enterprise in that capacity. Pretty much over the years, from what you've seen with artists getting record deals, first running independent, and then just what would you tell artists in terms of the type of deal that they pursue? Would you recommend to them going in a capacity of independence or possibly signing a deal? What are your feelings on it in terms of, especially given the current climate today of how the industry is?
Well, I think it depends on each artist and what you're looking for. You know, I don't think there's a single answer for everybody. You know, being independent, you're gonna get a larger piece of the pie, and you're gonna control your own destiny, and you're gonna call your own shots. But you know, it's harder to get that pie when you're on a major. That pie is handed to you. All you gotta do is sit back and chill. When you end it, you got to go out there, get the ingredients, cook it, learn how to do it, make sure it's not in the oven too long, cut it up right. Like, it's a whole different experience, you know.
Yeah, you know. What'd you say, King?
Yeah, I'm saying this is different. Because at the end of the day, it's about what you want.
Okay, we hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah, my fault. Yeah, I was going to say is that was a good answer because it's also about what you want out of it. Like, if you want to build a career, you want to be famous. The independent route will more so guarantee you a career because you want to, you pretty much concentrate more on the art. But if you want to get the clout and the fame, sign on to the major.
Yeah, yeah, you know, it just depends on what you're in it for and really what the road that suits you best. You know what I mean? That's what it comes down to. I hate to cut it short. I do got to go kind of soon, y'all. I know we've been on here a little while.
Understood.
But, you know, let me know where else we at.
No, we're good.
Doubt, man.
Look, we look. God, you're welcome back anytime. It goes without saying. Once again, congrats on the new project. You're welcome back anytime.
Yeah,
we look
thank
to
you. I wish
you
we would have talked
man.
About it a little bit. We didn't talk about it.
We're going to get it on the next one. We got caught up in everything else. But, man,
yeah.
Definitely, no but
doubt.
Look, next time, yeah, but next time you come back, we're definitely going to have to really, really, really just devote our time to really the process of it in terms of everything, the writing, the recording, coming it together, because there's so much more we got to talk about in terms of, you know, everything with it, man. But definitely, you're welcome back anytime.
Yeah,
man.
Nah, no
you know,
doubt.
Yeah, thank you so much again.
Nah, no doubt, man, no doubt. And I know you guys, you said you were in NC, right? So I think I know the show game is coming back in. So, you know, when I'm back in North Carolina, you know, a lot of people are reaching out about shows and all that type of stuff. So, you know, when I'm back out there, man, you guys come out to the show and, you know, we can vibe a little bit in person and rock out on the album and, you know, and just have a good time.
Show,
yes,
man.
Kings in North Carolina and I'm in Virginia. How's it got any Hampton Roads dates set up?
Oh, y'all split up. Okay. Yeah, we might. You know, I'm working on all that stuff over the summer. So you in Hampton. What part of North Carolina you in?
I'm in Raleigh.
King? And I'm in Hampton
Roads.
Okay,
are you right there?
Yeah, and I'm in Chesapeake, like Norfolk, Virginia Beach area.
Okay, word up. Yeah, I should be in both of those spots, you know, fairly soon, you know, probably over the summer and all that type of stuff. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, we'll make it happen, man. You know, when I'm in you guys' city, you know what I'm saying? You pull up to the show and, you know, we'll have a good time and you get to enjoy the music in person. It's always good to connect in person, you know?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Now, once again, thank you so much. Yes.
Nah, man, thank you for having me, man. I appreciate the time. I hate that I got to run, but I appreciate the time, man. It's always a pleasure.
Yes, sir.
Yep, man. In the meantime,
word up.
People are pushing and promoting the album too, man, because that's good music that needs to be heard.
Yeah, no, 100%. I appreciate the sentiment and the words, man, and that's what it's about. You know, it's about just continuing to push all that and the people knowing what it is, the people knowing where we at with it, and, you know, that certain types of hip-hop exist. You know, a lot of stuff gets pushed in one regard, and we got to make sure we push everything else in the other.
Definitely.
Word up. All right, brothers,
word
y'all
up.
Keep rocking out for hip-hop, man. I see where y'all at with it, man, and it's very much appreciated.
Definitely, man. God
bless. All
right,
what's up, bro?
Thank you. Until the next time. All right?
Word, definitely. Right. Peace and love.
Peace and love. Later. One.